Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Our neighbor, William Lichtenberg, is the William Rand Keenan Jr. Professor of History Emeritus.
Right, D.G.
At the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. In my mind, and in the mind of many other people, he is the leading expert. He's the person who acquaints us with the presidents of the United States. And so we have a welcome, Bill Lichtenberg.
Thanks, D.G.
I think everybody would agree that we have a mold breaker as our president now, for better or for worse, that President Trump is different in many ways from his predecessors. You have a great series of books in which you compare current presidents with Franklin Roosevelt.
Yes.
I won't say your president, but you grew up when he was president.
Mm-hmm.
And you compare how presidents have done sort of in the shadow of FDR. It's kind of tough, isn't it, dealing? We're far away and we got a president who doesn't fit any mold. How do you fit President Trump into the shadow of FDR?
Well, I guess the question I'm asked most, having most recently written a history of the 20th century American presidency, is have we ever had anybody like Trump before? And that's an easy question to answer because it's a flat no. In many ways, he is unique and not for the better, I think. The book you're talking about, D.G., In the Shadow of FDR, started as a series of lectures at Cornell, and I was talking about the impact of FDR on Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, his successors. The surprise that came when I gave these lectures in 1980 was that Ronald Reagan, whose political outlook appeared to be the absolute opposite of the New Deal, spoke of him so often in his acceptance address at the Republican National Convention that the New York Times the next day headlined its leader, its first editorial, Franklin Delano Reagan. And some years later, I was invited to lunch at the Reagan White House, and Reagan carried on about how thrilled he was to have been a radio announcer in Des Moines and having heard that voice, when Roosevelt came to Iowa. In writing the book, I've always been able to take advantage of the numbers of ways that presidents have quoted Roosevelt. And the book, as you were indicating, has been revised numbers of times. And the current edition is from In the Shadow of FDR, from Harry Truman to Barack Obama. So I've thought about carrying this on since it started out with Reagan and moved on through the Bushes and Clinton and, to Obama. But I've been hesitant for two reasons. As the presidency has unfolded, or even before that, what was revealed during the campaign, I wasn't sure I wanted my name and Trump's name on the cover of the same book. But more than that, there's a problem because whereas with other presidents, I could go to LexisNexis or other sources and find the numbers of times they had quoted Franklin Roosevelt, there is no indication that Trump ever has, that he has even any awareness of who Franklin Delano Roosevelt was, which isn't surprising because he seems to have almost no knowledge of the American past. Almost every president who goes into the White House has a deep sense that he's part of history, looks about the halls, looks at the portraits, realizes that he is one in a magisterial array. There's no indication that that our current president has that sense at all. The only president I can think of to whom he has alluded is Andrew Jackson. And Jackson, who...
He has his portrait.
Yes.
Often in the pictures of Trump, we'll see the Andrew Jackson in the background.
That's right, T.G. The one of the first things our president does is decide whose portrait he wants in that place of honor. And Andrew Jackson was chosen. And Andrew Jackson, for a long time, was regarded as the patron saint of the Democratic Party. Jackson Day dinners. FDR himself referred to Jackson in a memorable speech. But Jackson today has come to be looked at as somebody who grabbed power, was a racist, mistreated Indians, set us on the course.
Are you describing Jackson or Trump?
Jackson. Ah, there we are. And so it's been suspected that this admiration for Jackson does, as your interjection suggests, finding an identity there with his own.
Well, this is interesting, and it's a diversion, I guess, on Jackson. But when I was growing up and studying history, Schlesinger's The Age of Jackson was a classic, and it was not uncritical of Jackson and some of his mistakes, but by and large, it was a celebration of bringing the mainstream American into the Western Americans into politics for the betterment of democracy.
Yeah.
I thought, or at least we don't size Jackson up exactly that way anymore.
That's right. Schlesinger and I were colleagues at Harvard at about that time, and the main sense one had of Jackson was that after a long reign of patrician presidents, especially presidents who had been part of the Virginia dynasty. We finally had a man of the people who brought about mass participation, expansion of the electorate, fought the Second Bank of the United States, was an advocate of common folk, all for the better.
I'm pushing you, and I don't expect you to say yes to this, but in some respects, Trump is for the modern day what Jackson was in terms of breaking the mold of a insider deep state government that didn't really respond either emotionally or with practical that Trump opened the door for the participation of a lot of people who felt left out and ignored by the presidents who were in the tradition one way or another of Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, that is sad.
I didn't expect you to say yes to that, but comment on it.
Well, what one has to remember is that Trump got a few million less votes than his rival, Hillary Clinton, in the election, and the there were numbers of reasons for his success that we're still trying to sort out, and to some extent, at least, what you're saying is true, that if he didn't open the door for them, there were numbers of people, particularly working class voters who did not go to college, who identified with Trump and did not identify with his opponent and with previous presidents who were perceived to be an elite.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that this is the it's a strained, I think, comparison. But I, in Schlesinger's book, I still remember how on Inauguration Day these people crashed into the White House and essentially tore it apart. And they were, but they were celebrating. It's ours now. All those people who kept us from, you know, looked down on us and kept us from being a part of it. Now we showed them. And I hear some of the echoes of that from some of my friends who were. Still support Trump, but they say he crashed down the barriers. We identify with him, and so maybe Andrew Jackson is the right portrait to be up there.
Well, there's a curious aspect to it is that Jackson was a very wealthy man with a plantation in Tennessee tied to. Wealthy interests in the state of Tennessee. He was far from being a tribune of the people in that sense, but he did represent, if not the frontier, something close to the frontier. And that scene you're describing, D.G., on Inauguration Day was of people who'd come in from the West and tramp on all of the upholstery, drink too much julep, smash through windows. And it seemed to be, in the words of a Supreme Court justice, the triumph of King Mob. yeah, that's true.
I'm visiting with Professor William Lechtenberg. We're talking about the presidency, as I often have the privilege to do with Professor Lechtenberg, and he and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Professor William Lechtenberg. We're talking about presidents. Bill Lechtenberg likes to talk about Roosevelt, and I want him to talk about Trump, and I'm having trouble getting him to say, let me, you know, just, we have to stretch, I guess. But Franklin Roosevelt, whom you admire but don't assert that he was perfect, had a complicated relationship with Congress. I've heard you give talks about how the president it wasn't an easy, wasn't always easy for Roosevelt with Congress. And President Trump also is coming on to a period in which relations with Congress are not going to be easy. He has certain attitudes about them, and he gets tripped up surprisingly sometimes. Can you see any identity of this clash between the presidency and Congress as represented by these two presidents?
Well, all presidents have conflicts with Congress. I recall when I was working with Ken Burns on a film. The premiere of it was in Washington, and the Clintons gave a beautiful picnic on the White House lawn, and President Clinton, alluding to one of my books, said, "Well, Roosevelt had trouble with the Senate too, didn't he?" Talking about what his experience was at that time. But I'm more impressed by the contrast of between Trump's contempt for Congress's declaration of a national emergency, and what Roosevelt does when he comes to power. because he comes in to the worst domestic crisis in all of American history. Not only are there millions unemployed, many literally starving to death, but the banking system has broken down. There's a run on the banks in Michigan and in other states. And on the very eve of his inauguration, the head of the New York Stock Exchange goes to the rostrum, and the traders are expecting the announcement that trading is about to begin, and instead he announces the New York Stock Exchange is closing down. So if we talk about emergency, this is a real emergency, unlike the fake one we've been hearing about recently. But Roosevelt doesn't declare a national emergency. Instead, the very first thing he does is call Congress back to Washington into session. And throughout the first 100 days, he's able to reach out to members of Congress of both parties, Republicans like Hiram Johnson, for example, who vote for the series of 15 proposals that he presents in that historic first 100 days. And he is very, very careful of what belongs to Congress and what does not belong to the executive. And despite being one of the strongest presidents in all of American history, he carries that respect through all of his more than three terms in office.
Well, Roosevelt, when confronted with difficulties with Congress, was willing to look around to use to find the executive power he could use without congressional assent.
Well, there is a confusion in the current controversy about Trump between the use of executive power and the declaration of a national emergency. They're not the same thing. There are times when numbers of presidents, going back to the very beginning, used the form of an executive proclamation. At least as many important executive agreements in foreign policy as treaties, and the Supreme Court has treated them as having the same merit in the law. But declaring a national emergency is a much more serious matter, particularly if it's a way to avoid the will of Congress, which is what is happening right now.
Well, you would generally be, this is a question,
yes. You'd
generally be approving of strong actions that presidents took, putting aside the declaration of
yes. National
emergency, but in the context of where there are ambiguities about whether or not the president has authority, or based on what some of my predecessors did that might not have been strictly in accordance with what the constitutional framers had in mind, I can take advantage of that. You haven't been someone who says, we got to stop this accumulation of power in the presidency.
You're absolutely right. No, a fair point. You were talking about Arthur Schlesinger earlier, D.G., and in the Nixon era, Arthur, who had written a trilogy on Franklin Roosevelt, who had celebrated Jackson wrote a new book, The Imperial Presidency, expressing his alarm. And I, in writing about the presidency, and I'm now writing about the first American presidents from Washington to Jackson, will be the next book. I have, as you said, thought expansion of executive power was a good thing, because often Congress has been prey to special interests and the leadership in conserving national resources, in creating breakthroughs like the Social Security Act, have largely come from presidents. But I have to say that these last 2 years have made me have given me pause, and it's affecting what I'm writing right now.
Are the precedents set on this grabbing of power and the approach to the presidency? Is this setting precedents that will be disturbing for our way of government long beyond the time Mr. Trump is no longer in the White House?
Oh, I think so.
And can you talk about that?
Well, what's at least troubling, we don't know what they'll do about it, troubling some Republican senators, because if he can declare a national emergency just to have his way with Congress, there's no reason a Democratic president who may be shortly on the horizon couldn't do the same thing. And there's worry of the precedents that are being set. It's going to take us a long time to recover from this presidency and a whole lot of different areas. The shambles of foreign affairs, what's happened to the conservation of our resources, a lot of serious damage has been done and is being done, and I feel will be done. So it's we have a big assignment, all of us as American citizens.
So
in the years ahead.
A historian in the future may be called on to write the book, The Presidency and the Shadow of Donald Trump.
That would be a worthwhile project, yes.
If you join us late, I'm visiting with our friend, Professor William Lechtenberg, and we're talking about the presidency. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with our friend Bill Lechtenberg, our fellow Chapelhillian, also professor emeritus of history at the University of Keenan, professor emeritus, I should say, at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Well, I want you, if you will, to visit let me just say this. Franklin Roosevelt had some challenges with the courts.
Yes.
And he had one approach. President Trump says he has trouble with the courts. In fact, you were talking about his declaration of national emergency. He said he expected to lose.
Yeah.
All the way until in the district courts, in the federal court
circuit
of appeals.
Circuit court, yeah.
Circuit courts of appeal. The Supreme Court would take care of him. Did you shudder when he said that?
Yes, yes. Well, one of the interesting things about your question, D.G., is that it relates to what you were asking me earlier about how would one deal, pardon me, with the Trump in the shadow of FDR in a book. Pardon me. And one of the most interesting developments, unexpected in the last year, have been the number of articles that have advocated a return to court packing.
The court packing after Trump or with Trump?
Now that people ought, as members of Congress, ought to be introducing legislation to pack the Supreme Court in order to stop Trump from turning it into a political vehicle. He has already had the Kavanaugh appointment. In the case of U.S. V. Hawaii, the court has sustained his anti-Muslim actions on immigration, and
let's take a quick break, and Bill Luckenberg and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Professor Luckenberg and I took a cough break. So I want to I don't want to leave the court packing idea, but it you kind of caught me by surprise, because I thought, why in the world would we add justices to the Supreme Court when Trump is president and then let him appoint more?
Yes.
You weren't talking about that. This is for after Trump, right?
Well, the legislation would be introduced now. The expectation is that it would take a considerable amount of time, particularly with the Republican-controlled Senate. If one could imagine it's being enacted at all, and by the time program was set, there could be a new president of the United States.
Well, that reminds me, some of your most interesting talks have been about court packing in Franklin Roosevelt's time, and I thought, you described Franklin Roosevelt tried this court packing because the Supreme Court for him, like the Supreme Court for Trump, was not satisfactory. And Roosevelt tried one way to do it with court packing, but he succeeded when there were vacancies. And so Trump just skipped this court packing and has just waited for the vacancies to come along. And he's been successful in changing the court.
He has. And of course, he and inherited a previous Republican presidents and their appointments. So there is now a conservative bloc on the court, which has been strengthened by the appointment of Kavanaugh. And a lot of us are praying for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is my colleague at Columbia Law School, hoping that
She has some of the same magic you got. You just keep chug like the Energizer Bunny, just keep going. Yeah. The idea about the court packing might, I guess, what I'm saying is that this idea is something that might be addressed again, should there be a Democratic president and the ability in the Senate to confirm.
Yes, that's correct.
That we might take care of this success that Trump and the Republicans have had of putting in place a Supreme Court to last a long time with a dominating Kavanaugh and colleagues.
Yes.
I want to talk about another aspect of the comparisons between Trump and other presidents. I can remember with almost every president, there is a black sheep in the family or in the close-in support group, even to the extent of being corrupt, maybe not to
dis— Billy Carter?
Yeah, I'm thinking of Billy. But there have been Reagan boys, Bush boys who haven't all fit the mold. Yeah. And we've had wives who've gone off gone off and gotten a little bit crazy, and cousins and all yeah. sorts of things. The question, I guess, I think I know the answer, but can you compare the scandals of Trump and his close associates and family with the scandals that took over in the presidencies of other presidents?
Well, I think key question is to what extent his sons and other members of the family were involved in the collusion. Some were at the Trump Tower, and I think we'll have to wait for the Mueller report to come in, and the court actions that are taking place in New York State before we know what it is that they did.
Well, forget about the results, but there's this sort of, it's almost like planetary of the Trump presidency is just encircled with people who have gotten into bad legal trouble.
Oh, that is right.
And is what you write about, I guess you would say that the presidents that succeeded President Wilson, that there was a lot of
yes.
President Harding had a lot yes. of this same similar kind of circulating graft and corruption in one. Is this typical of the presidents?
No, I wouldn't say typical, but Harding would be a good example of when this happened. It happened under Harry Truman. The Missouri gang was called
the Pendergrass gang of the yeah.
Yeah. For the most part, corruption has not been a problem in the American presidency. Insider trading kind of difficulties. Even with Trump, there are so many things that concern me more than the members of his family mm-hmm. and what they may be doing. I don't think that when the final story is written that aspect is going to get nearly as much attention as other features of the Trump presidency.
That's really interesting, and I would never take the other side in a discussion with you. But for me, this is incredible, and that the presidency is surrounded by both the possibility of collusion in the campaign yeah. type. Collusion with the Russians. We don't know for sure about that, but we know for sure that some of these people were just crooks. While they're working in and around the Trump organization, they're just out there figuring out ways to illegally make more money to avoid taxes or evade taxes. And you don't think that says something that will be important in the evaluation of Trump in the future?
Well, I think what's you're on the right tack in talking about the miserable appointments that Trump has made. I think historians are going to be more struck by their incompetence, by their lack of qualifications for the office that they hold, and for the attitudes they bring into that office. The very latest thing that's happened is that Trump is talking about doing a serious investigation of climate change and putting a denier that there is any such thing as climate change in charge of the investigation. I think that's going to be the nub of a good deal of the.
Well, I've got a note that I wanted to talk to you about, but I'm very hesitant about it because you're so uncooperative in following my. But I was around when Franklin Roosevelt had a dog.
Oh yes, Fowler.
That there was a. It was almost like good PR for the president to have a good relationship with the pet. And you remember Barbara Bush's book?
Who wrote the dog wrote the book.
Dog wrote the book, right. I mean, but there was this companionship with and then President Obama had interesting pets. Does Trump have a dog?
Does not. And there was a very good piece on this in the Washington Post in the last couple of weeks, which is saying that this is a serious reflection on Trump, or at least a revelation of what kind of man he is. The inability to care enough for an animal and undergo that experience, and it's obviously doesn't rise to the level of what he's done in mistreating our allies or other aspects of the presidency, but it is an indication that we have an unfortunate character in the White House.
You can't aspire to be president without having a very strong ego and confidence in your, if not a genuine idea that you are better than anybody else or other people to do the job. To me, and I'd be interested in your thoughts about it, but to me, I've never seen anybody anywhere with the level of supreme, sort of an ego-driven, I'm the best, I'm always right, I can get this done, nobody else could get it done, everybody else did it right. I've seen people who were pretty high on that list, but never somebody as strong in that situation as our current president.
Oh, that's absolutely right. It's all about me. Comes up again and again, and his calling himself a genius, all kinds of misrepresentations that he's made, his attacks on anybody who doesn't agree that he's the greatest president who's ever come along, the high marks he gives himself, gives for his presidency. There have, as you say, there, any candidate for public office has to have a considerable ego, and there have been presidents who radiated some of what concerns us about Trump. It was said about Theodore Roosevelt that he wanted to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. And Lyndon Johnson was certainly not shy about his persona. But we've never had anyone as egocentric, one could say megalomaniac, as Trump.
Well, you mentioned Theodore Roosevelt, who, for all his good qualities, did have a very high regard for himself and a little bit lesser regard for the ability of others to get things done. Would he be the closest to Trump in our prior presence of a supreme confidence in?
I'm running. I'm doing a Rolodex in my mind of all of the presidents, but I think so. Yes.
Well, maybe we'll see Theodore Roosevelt's portrait take the place of Andrew Jackson. And if it ever should, you and I will know that we thought of it first.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, Bill Lichtenberg, it's always such a pleasure, and you challenge. You set me straight. Challenge me to think through things, and I'm grateful to you for doing that and for being willing to share an hour of your precious time.
Always great to be with you, D.G.
Thanks to Bill Lichtenberg, and thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you.